From WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard, produced with the support of 1. The Altech Ideas Conference and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and up first this hour, we Earthlings have been firing things up into space right and left lately. In early October, MASCOT, a small international probe about the size of a shoebox, touched down on the asteroid Ryugu and started sending back pictures. We posted a simulation under Facts and Information on our site, esweku.com. The NASA probe InSight made a perfect landing on Mars in late November, and since then, we've been treated to the sound of Martian wind. In early December, a Russian Soyuz spacecraft transported a crew of 3 to the International Space Station. China has launched a lander and rover to provide the first close-up look at the dark side of the moon. And on December 5th...
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
Liftoff. Lexington-based Space Tango sent a package to the space station aboard a SpaceX rocket. Here to tell us about it is Space Tango co-founder and chairman Chris Kimmel. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
And we'll get some background on Space Tango in just a few minutes. But first, if you would, you've had some recent excitement. If you would tell us about this latest launch, what did you send up to the space station?
Well, the launch on SpaceX 16, we actually had a pretty full portfolio of experiments, probably across a range of ideas and issues and projects. One of the ones that we sent up was one that we've been working on for some time with a company called Lambda Vision, which is a company out of Connecticut, which has developed designed a retinal implant that they believe is a considerable improvement, 10x improvement in the treatment of retinal diseases that lead to blindness, including macular degeneration. And we actually, on this particular launch to ISS, to our labs on ISS, will be manufacturing the prototypes of this design for this company. So it's a big deal. One, we're going to be actually manufacturing the prototypes of this particular product. And secondly, they believe that not only is space the microgravity environment, a better environment in which to manufacture these particular retinal implants, that if the design works as they suspect it will, then to achieve that kind of outcome, these retinal implants would have to be manufactured in microgravity. So that was one big project that we put out that we're very excited about. We also did a follow-on project with Budweiser, looking at barley seeds. We germinated some barley seeds for Budweiser Anheuser-Busch, and this time we're actually malting those barley seeds. They're interested in understanding at a much deeper level how these type of seeds react through germination and malting process in a zero-G environment. And then we had a project with Higher Orbits, which is a company that we work very closely with on evaluation of a particular type of fungus as a potential radiation barrier. So we're going to be actually growing some of that as well. And then we also had a really interesting experiment project went up called Paul, which is a powered ascent locker that was designed specifically by Space Tango that we tested on this particular mission that will allow for powered ascent up to ISS. Right now, one of the challenges for anybody going to ISS is the limited ability for powered ascent to station. And so this particular platform that was designed by our engineers is an attempt to really overcome some of those barriers.
Just as we've learned to harness solar energy, it sounds as if generally you're harnessing microgravity in a variety of ways.
That's correct. Really recent events, basically novel, really novel, farsighted policies by NASA that have come into existence here in the past several years, opening up the launch arena to private companies and to other companies, has opened up a vast new world of opportunities to get to space, to get to microgravity, and to get to the International Space Station. The second thing, which is equally important, is the relentless acceleration of improvements in microtechnologies and development of microtechnologies is just continuing at an awesome pace, and it's allowing us and others to build and design very, very small, relatively modest cost, relatively speaking, but incredibly high value technology to conduct experiments in microgravity. So really, for the first time, we and others are now able to really begin harnessing the microgravity environment of space for applications on Earth and elsewhere, which really hasn't been possible up to this point.
Another of your projects is titled ST-42, I guess Space Tango 42. What's that about?
That's correct. That's we just announced that about 3 weeks ago. We've been working on that idea for several years now, and we were very excited about it. ST-42 was announced by Space Tango as it's basically we rolled out our idea, our concept for a completely automated low Earth orbit research and manufacturing platform, in a sense, that would be capable of doing larger scale research and a much more scalable manufacturing in low Earth orbit as separate from the International Space Station. It would not be a replacement for that, obviously. As long as station is in orbit, companies like Space Tango will be using that, but more as an extension to Space Tango. So this particular platform is, again, a fully autonomous orbiting system that would allow for us to really expand a lot of the research and manufacturing that we're doing. And right now it's designed, we're projecting that we'll be ready to begin test flying it probably sometime around 2025 or 26.
So a booster rocket conceivably would lift off and carry that payload
Correct.
To that orbiting platform?
The orbiting platform would actually be retrievable. So what would happen is it would be on the top of a launch vehicle and that launch vehicle would put it into the particular orbit that the place it in the orbit it needs to be. And it would basically stay in space as long as it needed to conduct its research and manufacturing, whatever was designed to do at that point. Maybe it's retinal implants, maybe it's some kind of a pharmaceutical or whatever. And then once that is completed, it would return to Earth using existing recovery technology, return technology, and would then be basically unloaded. The products would be unloaded, et cetera, and then it would be reusable for the next time. So it would be customized for each particular mission.
I can't help but be curious about that return technology. What exactly does that entail?
Well, that just means it's nothing exotic. It's basically, you know, we're using heat shields and other kinds of technology that has been validated for many, many years. So the technology itself to design and to retrieve the platform back on Earth has been used for some time. So we're not going to be experimenting a lot with a lot of new things on that level. Where the really innovation will be is inside ST-42, which will be completely automated, run by AI and other kinds of technologies, and that will be where the real new design and capability comes from.
I think the SpaceX folks really raised the bar of expectations on Earth landings and on the return.
Absolutely.
With the ship that actually came back and landed just as we used to see them in sci-fi films.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And I'm going to ask you another question in just a minute that goes back to those sci-fi days. But first, I'd like to know, what is on Space Tango's to-do list? What do you have coming up?
Well, we have – right now we're launching about six times a year to space. We've got a big project that we're doing that is going to launch in 2019 that, as we announced recently with the National Stem Cell Foundation and the Michael J. Fox Foundation that deals with looking at some neurobiological issues related to Parkinson's and MS. And that project is scheduled to be – we'll probably be going up in 2019 with that. We're also looking at working with a company on some really innovative, far-reaching lab-on-chip technology, and we expect that to be in 2019. Of course, we'll be accelerating work on ST-42. We'll be really accelerating now that we've made the announcement. We've done some early engineering designs, et cetera. So that will have a part of the operation that's really beginning to concentrate on that. And we also have a number of plant biology experiments that we're continuing to work on. One with Joe Chappelle at the University of Kentucky, who's a drug design professor who's worked with Space Tango before on a number of projects, and this one in particular, where we did a mission with him and are looking at the constituent parts of a particular plant that are the basis for about 70% of chemo drugs. And so we're working with Joe now, probably, hopefully again, that we'll see that go up in 2019.
I will pull out that interview that we did with you two back in July, I believe it was, just as that project was going up, and post it on
our information and facts tab so that people can go to that and hear a little bit more in depth about that project.
Yeah, and I think we mentioned last time, also we announced in October that we've created a majority-owned subsidiary company to focusing on cannabinoids, basically hemp and cannabinoids, the biomedical health and biomedical piece of that that emerging industry. We happen to believe that CBD and other cannabinoid constituents and other kinds of things hold out real strong potential for health benefits and high-end health benefits to people on Earth. In fact, the first FDA-approved drug for epilepsy was just approved as which is derived from CBD. So we've got a subsidiary that we've created. We're getting going to really accelerate the launch of in 2019. Looking at that, so that's something else we're looking forward to.
It's always so good to get an update from you, Chris. It's like pulling out a stopper, and all this great information comes out. You guys are busy over there.
Yeah, very busy.
I referred to something from sci-fi earlier, and this is something that struck me as I was watching the simulation of the InSight Mars lander as they were demonstrating it coming down and how so perfectly it did everything. But lo and behold, there was an Earth vehicle getting ready to land on Mars that, for the life of it, looked exactly like a flying saucer from Mars, as we've always portrayed them in science fiction. And here we are sending flying saucers to Mars.
Yeah. I think people don't realize that really we already have become now a spacefaring society. I mean, people have been living on space station for many years now. Prior to that, it was the shuttle and, you know, the mirror and other things. So we've actually had humans in space for some time, and people do live on the station. And secondly, while they're not humans, the robots that we send to Mars and other places are extensions of the human race. And so in many respects, we are also inhabiting through our technology Mars, you know, an asteroid. Certainly, you know, humans have been to the moon, talking about going back. So really, we are truly a spacefaring civilization already. And for those of us who are your age and my age, I may be a little bit older than you, I'm not sure, but I remember back when I was in, you know, a younger person, where people, we didn't know that there actually weren't aliens on Mars.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't sure at all.
No, we were not sure. And scientists weren't sure. There was actually speculation. Well, maybe they're, you know, they're actually up there and we can't see, you know, et cetera. So it's really, when you see this kind of technology and realize that we have this permanent human presence, human through our technology presence on Mars, it's just amazing.
Do you think colonization is an inevitability in the future?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any doubt that in the future we'll be colonizing Mars, probably the moon, and perhaps other celestial bodies as well. I think it's just a normal extension of humans' quest to explore and to discover. And it's, you know, we've been doing this since the beginning of time, and I'm sure we'll continue.
Space Tango co-founder and chairman Chris Kimmel, always so fascinating to hear that all this is going on right here in Lexington. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, what is all of this screen time doing to our brains, our personalities, especially our kids' minds and characters? EKU psychology professor Myra Beth Bundy joins us to look at the latest research, and later in the hour, author Milton Tobey on his book, Shergar, Thoroughbred Racing's Most Famous Cold Case, plus the perils of a double major in college. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019 in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
We're back. The amount of time that small kids spend with small screens has soared in the last 5 years or so. Digital technology has transformed our lives in many positive ways, but how much of a good thing is too much of a good thing? How much screen time is too much screen time? Well, we're going to take a look at that question with the help of Dr. Myra Beth Bundy, a professor of psychology here at EKU. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's been this message out there that your child's going to be crippled and living in a different, a less advantaged dimension if they're not on that screen. It wasn't long ago that the worry was that students from wealthy households would have access to the internet earlier and have a leg up on tech skills, and that this would lead to a haves and have-nots digital divide. But now, according to a recent New York Times piece on this subject, worries over a new digital divide are rising. Silicon Valley parents, for example, are raising concerns over the impact screens are having on their children and are moving towards screen-free lifestyles, while the children of poorer and middle-class parents are being raised by screens. What's going on here?
So there was a set of articles that came out and some studies, and I think some parents heard that information and read that information and started questioning, should I be, you know, how much should I be limiting screen time? What should, you know, is screen time good? Is it bad? So there was that sort of burst of research. And now, just this year, some new things have come out, including the New York Times article you talked about, mm-hmm. that suggests there may be an economic divide in hours of screen time for children. And there's this interesting Lancet article that came out just a couple of months ago. And the title of this article is Limiting Children's Recreational Screen Time to Less Than 2 Hours a Day is Linked to Better Cognition. So with all of these, all of the research studies, there is variability because what kind of screen time did they look at? An important variable is passivity versus active nature of the screen time. For a long time, we've been noticing that passive viewing of television for kids may not be helping cognitive development. It could actually be harming language development. While active involvement, TV shows that get kids to answer questions or to try something out or to imitate a motor behavior, those may increase some skills. So we've been interested in this active versus passive dimension. And now, with technology exploding into so many other active, interactive ways, I think we need to keep looking at it and see what it's going to do. It seems like it's changing cognition, but some studies are suggesting positive changes may be possible, and some are suggesting some concerning kinds of things. One study that I looked at was comparing cognitive behavior and human behavior during reading versus during some sort of interactive screen time, and that it may not be better or worse. It may just be different. It was suggesting that reading I think that may be this 2018 Lancet study, that reading may pull out imaginative thought and contemplation versus technology interaction may pull out quick skimming for information and sort of quick assessment of a body of knowledge. So not saying that one is better than the other, but that it may be teaching our brains to engage in different ways with the medium.
When you think about the breadth of this, the pervasiveness of these devices among young children, we're talking 2, 3, 4, 5-year-olds today, is the science able to stay ahead of that curve? Because that's a mighty big chunk of the population that is in the digital native population that is going to be growing up quickly with this being their only experience, nothing to compare it with.
Yeah, I don't think research has been keeping up with it, because when I look at some of these studies, they're still talking about television, which I realize is still there, but it's not the newest thing that people are doing. So yeah, I think some of the research, because it's taking a while to collect this data, and we're particularly interested in longitudinal data, well, the new technologies are coming out so quickly that we can't even collect data on them quickly enough to report it before something new is happening. But I did want to talk about my sort of favorite study here that I found in The Lancet. And I think particularly parents listening to this may want to hear what this study has to say. So they're coming out with, this is a Canadian-based recommendation, 3 recommendations for 8 to 11-year-old kids for cognitive and sort of overall life, health, and fitness. And these are the 3 recommendations. 9 to 11 hours of sleep, less than 2 hours of recreational screen time, and at least 1 hour of physical activity per day. as sort of a holistic life recommendation. Maybe one in three children in the U.S. met none of the guidelines. 41% of U.S. children met one of these three guidelines, and only 5% of U.S. children met all three recommendations. So they've kind of looked at outcomes. Basically, the more of these three recommendations children meet, the better their overall cognitive scores were.
Here's another study for you, a 2012 Harvard study. It found that engagement with social media and our cell phones triggers the release of dopamine. Why, when we get a text, it feels so good. Dopamine is the same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, when we gamble. Does it follow that it's helping cope with the stresses of being an adolescent?
Well, I think – so one of the things that we've been talking about is sort of simply what does engaging with screens, what might it do? How might it change cognition? But another way, sort of another angle with this is what about sort of attention-attracting programs and apps and this sort of idea about addictive design, basically, for people of all ages. And I think you were going to give me another term for that.
It's the field of persuasive design, which is said to be playing a key role.
Well, I mean, what I know is what we all know, that on some of the video games that younger people play, and maybe some people of our age too, but on some of the gaming stuff and on some of the sites that many people use, social media sites, there are these cues and these ads and these click-me kind of attractants that make us want to keep going. And sometimes we're keeping going in a way that will grab our data. Sometimes we're keeping going in a way that might make us more susceptible to advertising or to paying. So games attract you so that you think your next big win is right around the corner, and you might pay a little bit more to get there. So there's
always that reward there.
An immediate and, yeah, an intense reward so that people keep going. So that it, what was the recommendation for 2 hours?
Yes.
Yeah, 2 hours of leisure screen time. Well, it can easily go up higher and higher as you're clicking deeper into these sort of attractants. So the Center for Humane Technology addresses that. So they have three things that they have four things that they sort of want for moving forward, embracing technology, but trying to use it in a way that helps people instead of hurting people in society. So I think they're advocating a little bit less toward persuasive design and more toward what they're looking at as humane design. So humane design would attract people to the kinds of technology that are found to be helpful for people or useful or life-enhancing or quality of life-embracing, that kind of thing. And they've also talked about getting active politically about what kind of, you know, suggestions, possible restriction, enhancements we might make in our society to try to make technology a force for good and happiness instead of causing problems. They are into cultural awakening to the impact of technology and how we're growing with it, how people are changing with it, and then trying to engage employees with using technology as a tool, I suppose, instead of being the tool of technology, if that makes sense, sort of active, intentional use of
because
technology.
Because it does, the pendulum swings between the two all the time.
That's right.
UCLA research finds that too much face-to-screen time and not enough face-to-face interaction can degrade kids' ability to read each other's emotions. And in that Times article that we talked about, a Kansas City pediatrician concerned about his child's heavy screen time is quoted as asking, "What happens to my daughter if she can't communicate over dinner? How is she going to find a spouse? How is she going to interview for a job?" What would you tell this worried parent?
I saw that section of the article. Well, one of my students, I told you I was consulting with my doctoral students today about this, and he was bringing up the function of mirror neurons, which react to, which help people imitate each other, sort of help people get in sync with the other's body and eye contact and sort of a cornerstone to human interaction. He was just saying he'd be interested to know how mirror neurons are activated and how they function during face-to-face time, and can a screen duplicate that or not? So how in sync are two people when they're texting together or maybe FaceTiming together versus real timing together. So I'd like to know more about that too.
Thanks to these devices and thanks to the internet, we don't have to wait for things now. We can place that order on Amazon right now. We don't have to check on movie times. We can watch the movie now. You want to watch a TV series? You can binge. We don't have to spread it out over many weeks and months as we used to. How is the technology and the instant gratification that it enables affecting patients with things that take time and lived experience, things like love and fulfillment, joy, love of life, self-confidence?
I think we still need more research, as we sort of talked about earlier, looking at different kinds of screens and different kinds of technology. But I know that one of the studies that my students and I reviewed was looking at how this sort of immediate access to information might just be changing skill levels. So instead of relying on and rehearsing memory skills, children might be relying on and rehearsing information search skills. So it may or may not necessarily be a bad change, but it may just be in a change in the way that people go after information. So I wonder if we could, I wonder if research will find out that there may be a change in the way that people interact on their devices. That's what I'd like to know. Is interaction done differently via device rather than face-to-face? And is that worse, better, or just different?
Is it fair to say that all of this really is inevitable? The technology is here to stay, and it's only going to become more pervasive and more ubiquitous in our lives. So understanding how it works in the way that you're trying to figure out, I think only makes sense, of course, as we go forward.
I think so, and I want you to listen to this cool analogy that my students came up with.
Great.
At first, we tried to parallel technology to candy, but then I told them that this wasn't a good parallel because there's really no redeeming value. Candy could be a reinforcer or a reward, but it's not really good nutrition. And I don't think we can say that technology is equivalent to candy. Mm-hmm. So we thought about fats. The idea, and I wrote this down because I thought it was such a possibly apt analogy. You have to integrate fats into your diet because you need some fats. But if you only ate fats, then you could have a problem. So as you integrate fats into your diet and as you sort of struggle to get the right balance of fat, which is attractive, and other things, could it be the same with technology? We have to try to integrate technology into our lives in a way that helps us in the right balance and not the way that it takes the place of all the other kind of real-time things that you talk about, like love and social instinct and face-to-face kinds of things. And I really think that's what the Center for Humane Technology is trying to suggest that people do. It's not a Luddite institution. And in fact, some of the people that are part of this are former high-tech geniuses. Hmm. They're just trying to get people to, I guess, use technology in an intentional rather than an accidental way.
I kind of feel like what we're hearing out there collectively is slow down for a moment, folks. Get a handle on this and figure out how much fat you need in your life. How much screen time you can make work, because we all tend to kind of catapult through life and careen through life and not stop and reflect on that kind of thing. But I think it's becoming really important to do that. And how about in the workplace? I've heard it said that many young adults who have been raised with these expectations of instant gratification have a hard time adjusting to entry-level work. They see the summit, not the mountain. They first must climb, developing perspective and a skill set along the way.
Interesting. I really focused on children in my research. I didn't look at young adults quite as much, but we can think about how to take the ideas we discussed with children and apply it to young adults. If children are learning to be skimmers and quick consumers of information rather than possibly more measured imaginers of information, we might think about how that could change the new generation of adolescents and eventually workers, I think, is what you're asking about. We certainly hear, as a professor here at EKU, we hear a lot of people that are talking with us about teaching, talk to us about how to reach younger learners and how younger learners have certain expectations for technology in the classroom and for active learning rather than reading long passages of text. So I think people are thinking about this at the post-secondary education level, And eventually it'll come into the workplace as well.
We only have a little bit more time left, and I want to ask you, young parents who are concerned about this, that their kids are engaging in too much screen time versus those who rely on it for babysitting, are struggling. I've seen it happen with my children and their children, struggling to keep it under control, as we were just talking about. What can you tell them about a reasonable and a safe amount of time that their kids can spend on their devices in a day? Is it that 2 hour?
That's the guideline that I have sitting here in my fingers, but I don't think you can decide that for every child. Depends on the age of the child. We don't want an 8-month-old baby to be having 2 hours of screen time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the developmental needs of their child, the age that their child is at, the type of screens that they're getting. This was a recommendation for 8 to 11 years, 2 hours of recreational screen time. Remember the hour of physical exercise, 9 to 11 hours of sleep. If we're looking at a baby or a preschooler, of course, just as they need more sleep at that age, they probably need more physical interaction with the real world and probably a little less screen time. So people need to talk to their pediatricians about what kinds of developmental milestones their children are reaching for at the particular time. And is this something that can be met through the screen, or does it need to be met through people or the real world? I've seen again and again suggestions that parents engage in technology use with their children, so their children aren't in their own room or in a section of the house alone engaging, but parents are viewing media with their kids, interacting with media with their children. So that's something simple that parents can try to do. But I know, time demands, as you said, this sort of catapulting, hurried society. Mm-hmm. It can be hard for parents to find the time to do that.
I appreciate and am interested in the fact that you engage your students in this discussion today. Is this something that you think will carry on a little bit? Can we revisit it down the road?
I hope so.
Okay, great. Dr. Myra Beth Bundy, professor of psychology here at Eastern Kentucky University, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Tech industry insiders and children's media watchdogs have gotten together to launch a Truth About Tech campaign, and you can go to Facts and Information on our website, esweku.com, and download their Roadmap for Kids Digital Well-Being. It pushes for the creation of ethical standards for tech companies, lobbying for government regulation and government-funded research on the effects of all these screens, and it calls for digital literacy curricula in schools. Groups like Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood are demanding that Facebook shut down its Messenger chat for kids. Shareholders are demanding that Apple study the effects of its phones on children and offer better parental controls. Many of these voices are not your typical professional worry warts. They're former Silicon Valley execs themselves. Coming up after the break.
The last thing they told him before they let him go was, if you tell the police, we'll kill your family. And with the IRA involved, that's the threat that you believe.
Thoroughbred writer Milton Tovey tells us about his new book, Taking Shergar, Thoroughbred Racing's Most Famous Cold Case. It's about a racehorse kidnapped in Ireland back in the 80s, quite possibly by the Irish Republican Army. And Colin Overton, editor-in-chief of the EKU student newspaper Eastern Progress, has a look at the pros and cons of taking on a double major. Or, put another way,
yes, but also no.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
June 3rd, 1981, the 202nd annual running of Ireland's Epsom Derby.
15 lengths at least. Wallace Whitburn looks round. He's on his own. Shergar, clear of his field. He's climbed this mountain. He has eased up. Shergar wins the derby.
Shergar was an Irish-bred, British-trained thoroughbred racehorse. He disappeared in 1983, and it turns out that he was kidnapped, and there was a ransom. His story has been made into two films, two documentaries, and several books, the latest, Taking Shergar, published by the University Press of Kentucky, has captured our attention here at Eastern Standard, and I'm pleased to welcome its author, Milton Tobey. Thanks for joining us, Milton.
Thanks for having me on the program, Tom. I appreciate it.
Let's begin with a little bit about you, Milton. You've been writing about the horse industry for many, many, many years. And if you could, just give us some highlights of your writing career.
Sure, happy to. I started working for the Blood Horse in 1973. That was Secretariat's year, which is a good time to start writing about horses. Mm-hmm. I stayed at the Blood Horse for 12 years, lived overseas doing freelance photography for 6 years, came back to Kentucky, went to law school, practiced law for quite a while, taught equine law at the University of Louisville's equine industry program, but have been writing all the time and still doing it.
Okay, that's your background. Now, how about a little bit of background prior to his disappearance about Shergar?
Shergar was bred by the Aga Khan IV, who is the spiritual leader of about 15 million Ismaili Muslims. He is one of the richest men in the world, and he also has a remarkably successful racing stable that actually traces back to his grandfather. Shergar was bred by the Aga Khan. He was trained in England by Sir Michael Stout. He was the first Epsom Derby winner for the trainer, the owner, and the jockey. He was European Horse of the Year in 1983. He was syndicated during that year for £10 million, which is in the neighborhood of $20 million. He stood his first season in 1982. In 1983, a few days before the start of the breeding season, he was stolen.
In 1999, Sean O'Callaghan, a former member of the Irish Republican Army, published details of the theft and stated that it was an IRA operation, supposedly to raise money to purchase weapons. Has that claim ever been verified?
That depends on what you mean by verified. The case is still open as far as the Irish authorities are concerned, so the files are closed. But during an investigation trying to substantiate an insurance claim, a gentleman in Dublin named David Horgan talked with an Irish police officer named Sean Feely, who was part of the investigation. He got an affidavit from Sean Feely, and Feely said that he had read O'Callaghan's accounts, that he was familiar with the investigation, with all the files, and in his opinion, what Sean O'Callaghan said was true. That's the closest we'll get to an official statement for the time being.
I know that you've traveled to Ireland. You've spoken to a good many people about this and done your research, of course. But can you tell us what is known about what happened to Shergar that day?
That's still hard to know. Again, the only account we really have to rely on is Sean O'Callaghan's and Sean Feely's verification of it. But basically what happened, you know, it was one of the coldest days in Ireland. And if Shergar hadn't been stolen, that would be what February the 8th, 1983 would be known for. Hmm. But you know, early in the evening, a gang of armed men entered the farm. Ballymanny Farm was a few miles from Kildare, which is the thoroughbred center of Ireland. And there was no security. There was no reason to think that there needed to be any. And at the time, the security was a heavy wooden gate, a chain with a snap, and a sign that says, "Visitors, please close the gate." They marched up to the house where the stud groom who took care of Shergar lived. They knocked on the door. Some of them took the family captive, essentially, and held them under arms. They took James Fitzgerald, who was the stallion groom, down to get help loading Shergar into a bedraggled trailer. Within a half an hour, they drove away and were gone. They also kidnapped James Fitzgerald. They took him away in a separate car, drove him around the countryside for a couple of hours, and released him in a small village 30 miles away from Kildare. The last thing they told him before they let him go was, "If you tell the police, we'll kill your family." Hmm. And with the IRA involved, that's the threat that you believe.
Did a ransom demand follow?
There were actually three ransom negotiations, three separate series of phone calls. But yes, there was a ransom demand for £2 million, which was the figure that the gang who took James Fitzgerald told him to expect. There also was a code word, King Neptune, that they told him to tell Shergar's people to listen for. And that was one set of calls. The first set of calls actually started with a thoroughbred trainer in Northern Ireland that the police dismissed as bogus. And later, there was a third set of negotiations with a gentleman named Captain Sean Barry, who was a former military man who happened to be head of the Irish Thoroughbred Breeders Association at the time. And he negotiated with people who claimed to have Shergar for, you know, several weeks. There was never any real evidence that the horse was alive when the negotiations were going on. And if you believe Sean O'Callaghan's report, the horse had been injured and killed a few days after the theft occurred.
And so in the meantime, no money actually changed hands?
No.
Mm-hmm. Was anyone ever arrested in connection with this case?
No. There have been no arrests, no charges. No one's ever been jailed. It's still an open case.
And Shergar's body, has it ever been found?
There was never a trace.
Did you gain access to information that had not been included in some of those other publications or films?
I found a number of things that people had never seen before. You know, one of them was Sean Feely's affidavit. To my knowledge, that was never shown to anyone outside of the insurance company that was involved in the dispute. There were other things. There was a Polaroid photograph that I am 99% sure was used as proof from one of the gangs who claimed to have Shergar that they actually did have him and that he was still alive. There was a report, a complete report from the Shergar syndicate that owned the horse to the syndicate members that, again, to my knowledge, was never publicized. So there was quite a bit of information I came across that no one had been involved with before.
What did you find out about the question of why Shergar was standing stud in Ireland when he could have been here in the United States commanding a much, much higher stud fee?
That was one of the puzzles that I was interested in investigating. What I think was a reason that very few people have given credence to is the actions of the current Aga Khan's grandfather. He won the Epsom Derby in 1930 with a horse named Blenheim, who was a very successful sire in Europe, but he sold the horse to an American syndicate and incurred the wrath of breeders in England and France and Ireland who had mares booked to the stallion. A few years later, he sold two more Epsom Derby winners to syndicates in the United States. I'm convinced that one of the reasons Shergar stayed in Ireland was in the back of the Aga Khan's mind, he knew that he didn't want to send another Derby winner to the United States.
Hmm. What brought the IRA into this picture?
The IRA was running out of money. In a TV interview, Sean O'Callaghan said that they were spending at the time about £2 million to buy weapons and just to have money to operate. The United States at the time was the leading supplier of arms and weapons to the IRA, which was a surprise. Libya was second. The IRA was relying on those two countries almost exclusively, and the weapons pipeline from the U.S. to Ireland was shut down by the FBI. Muammar Gaddafi in Libya lost interest, and almost overnight, they were in dire financial straits. They kidnapped people. They set up a chain of kidnappings, largely grocery store executives. There was some thought that they did that because they assumed grocery stores take in a lot of small unmarked bills and it'd be easy to get a ransom. The Irish police thwarted all of those. And somewhere along the line, somebody thought, hey, let's steal a horse. Shergar was a national hero in Ireland. The fact that he had been syndicated for a lot of money was public knowledge. Everybody knew who Shergar was. They knew that his owner or breeder, the Aga Khan, had a lot of money. I don't think the IRA really understood the idea of a syndicate, which meant that 35 people actually owned Shergar, and that trying to negotiate a ransom deal with 35 people was just not going to work. And finally, the Irish police didn't want them to pay a ransom, and most of the syndicate members didn't either. They were afraid that if they paid a ransom for Shergar, any valuable stallion in Ireland would be the next target.
Mm-hmm. You did a lot of interviewing for this book and with a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting characters. Who among them would you say stands out as the most compelling or interesting?
That's a difficult question because there were a lot of interesting people. The most interesting person, I think, was Captain Sean Barry. I mentioned him earlier as being head of the Irish Thoroughbred Breeders Association. He was caught up in this because of his job. He was a former military man. He was very distressed at the time with what the IRA was doing. He remains very distressed with what happened during the Troubles, and he is convinced that the IRA was involved. But he was led into negotiations. I mentioned three sets of negotiations. He conducted one of them with people who claimed to have Shergar. This went on for quite a while. There was a period of time when Captain Barry was threatened, when his family was threatened, when he realized that the people he was negotiating with knew personal things about him and his family. So they'd been watching him. The police moved into his house. They tapped his phones for several weeks, and it became a nightmare for him. But he, during the process, put together notes of what was going on little pieces of paper. And he assembled them and gave me 18 pages of single-spaced typewritten notes of his recollections. And that was really what got the ball rolling for me with Shergar.
This story, this book, Taking Shergar, with its historical context, the mystery, the intrigue, as well as its portrayal of the thoroughbred world, appeals to a pretty broad variety of interests. And it's not limited just to horse racing. And although there have already been a couple of films based on this story, I just wonder, in this age of Netflix, of Amazon Prime, any thoughts of a screenplay?
I think that would be wonderful, partly because there's information here that no one's ever seen before,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And partly because the previous feature film about Shergar was not very good. It opened one day at one theater in London and closed almost immediately. And in the end, in the film, Shergar was rescued by a lad who rode him off the cliffs of Moher into the sea.
Terribly credible then.
I think it would be ripe for something on the History Channel, for example. They had a special not too long ago trying to track down relations between a serial killer in the U.S. and Jack the Ripper. I think it would be very good, again, because there are things that nobody's seen before.
Well, we'll drop that hint out there. And Milton Tobey, we appreciate you spending time with us. Milton is author of Taking Shergar, Thoroughbred Racing's Most Famous Cold Case, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thanks, Milton.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the interest in the book.
Preparing for a career, it's on a lot of minds on college campuses these days, including Eastern Kentucky University, where Colin Overton, editor of the student paper Eastern Progress, has been out on campus talking to classmates and faculty about the pros and cons of what some see as a path to a good job, the double major.
A typical way for college students to get ahead in the job market is by double majoring. It's a phenomenon that's grown in recent years, with schools like Vanderbilt reporting over 30% of students having more than one major. At EKU, double majors account for around 6% of all enrolled students. That amount has fluctuated over recent years, but since 2009, it's gone up 21%, according to the EKU Office of Institutional Research. In October, New York Times columnist David Leonhardt wrote a column plainly titled, "Do Not Double Major," where he chastises this trend. He says students today are using multiple majors to get ahead in what he calls the credentials arms race. They're overloading on classes and coursework instead of exploring one or two areas and finding what they're really passionate about. On top of all that, he says the trend exacerbates income inequality, making upper-middle-class students seem more qualified than working-class and poorer students. Catherine Davis is a junior double major in Spanish and deaf and hard-of-hearing education. For her, double majoring will help her work with deaf kids from diverse backgrounds.
Well, there's a high percentage of children who are deaf that their parents either do not use ASL or that their parents, their first language is not English. So it's very useful to be able to communicate with multiple students in multiple ways in order to ensure a holistic educational approach.
Then I asked how many hours a week she put into studying for both majors.
Too many hours to count. I'll be up until at least midnight doing homework most days, and I also work 40 hours a week, so.
Carson Stanifer is a sophomore and majors in economics and political science. Like a lot of students, he thinks double majoring gives him a competitive edge. He has thoughts about lobbying, being a lawyer, advocacy, but he's still weighing his options. He also juggles a membership with the Alpha Psi Omega Theater Fraternity, a student senator position with Student Government Association, and presides over the College Democrats Club. I ask if it felt like his major is cut into other activities.
It can be hard but I don't think it necessarily cuts into anything. I've planned it out where I don't have to take, you know, extra classes, like 18 hours a semester or anything like that. So I would say no. I think if you're interested enough to major in it, that you should be fine.
Before declaring both of his majors, Stanifer said he talked it out with his family and professors. He said everyone was supportive of it, minus one professor who thought he should stick with one major, and then add a couple of minors.
I think ideally we would encourage double majoring in conjunction with internship and co-op.
That's Paolo Capretti, director of the EKU Center of Career and Co-op. He credits part of the trend to an increase in people getting degrees. There is a need to stand out.
If I receive, like it happened to me, 75 applications for an opening, and they all have a degree, and it's required, so it does matter, I'm going to start looking for other things at that point to differentiate. I can't interview all 75 people.
Although Career and Co-op deals with double major students less often, Capretti doesn't think double majoring hampers students, at least if they can handle it. He says students that often do double major show a lot of initiative and transferable skills like leadership and critical thinking. Still, he says students should ease into it.
I would encourage it as long as the student has the shoulders to carry that burden. Mm-hmm. You know, what I've recommended in counseling when students had a strong interest in two areas, instead of diving immediately into double majoring, I would encourage them to try taking a class in the subject, both subjects, mm-hmm. and see how it went. Maybe a class that is neither the heaviest nor the lightest, so that it kind of represents a credible assessment of what it's like to be in that major.
There is evidence to suggest that double majors fare better after graduation. Statistics from The Conversation, an independent not-for-profit news site, show that students who tack on a second major often do earn more. For example, liberal arts students who take on a second degree in a business major earned, on average, 7.9% more than their liberal arts peers with only one major. Students who take on a major in a STEM field earn around 9.5% more on average. The difference is most prominent in management and sales. That's not to say all double majors are driven by the money factor. For students like Stanifer, taking on an extra major means more to fall back on.
I think it really just depends on what you want to do in your life. Mm-hmm. If you don't know, I kind of encourage double majoring, if you don't know, because no matter what, you're going to have two things to fall back on instead of one.
For Eastern Standard and the Eastern Progress, I'm Colin Overton.
And if you would like to check out that David Leonhardt column Colin Overton mentioned, you'll find the link under Facts and Information on our website, esweku.com. That wraps this week's edition. WEKU's Eastern Standard is produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our chief production engineer. A listing of Eastern Standard content partnerships and other information about ES can be found online at esweku.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.